And what can we do today? So your foundation?
Today we have to destroy everything. It's the only way we have to do. Remember, in Dadaism, they were about anti-art. Mm-hmm. In Surrealism, there was anti-reason. But also, in music, when we have the amazing musician, master, called Erik Satie, mm-hmm. the Dadaist musician that passed away in 1924, he was a very, very strong revolutionary of sounds. Yeah. And then when you move on in the 20th century, we have John Cage, and also we have, of course, Edgar Varèse, who invented electronic music. Tonight, when you go to a nightclub to dance, all this music you listen, the electronic music, is thanks to Edgar Varèse. So those guys were so ahead in his time that were able to see the future. And without no electronical means or without any real revolutionary items, they were somehow able to do whatever they were able possible to do with a very limited means of creation, you know. So with Miro and Satie and Breton and Artaud, you can see how those people were just making tabula rasa and recreate themselves from ground zero. So today, in the 21st century, in this completely tired society, in this society that is complaining all the time, and we have so many things that are much better than many years ago, we have to somehow find a way to make tabula rasa and reinvent ourselves again, you know.
But what to do with the works of your grandfather? So you
and the foundation.
It would be really the logic to destroy everything, you know. So you understand. I would not like to.
No, I understand. No.
But it's, you know, if you are really radical, try to do it too, because I think it's really important not just to think about, but to react, to realize, you know. So what do you think about this idea?
I think that you are right, because the world belongs to young people. The world belongs to the new generation that are 18, 19, 20 years old. These people can really change the world by living away, going away from Europe, going to Asia, going to America, going to South Africa, going to South America, and experiencing new approaches to life. And then come back to Europe and reinvent ourselves from ground zero. That's the only way to see, because if we remain here, nothing is possible. I have to go away.
So we must burn everything?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the metaphorical point of view. Yeah. You have to burn Picasso, you have to burn Miro, you have to burn Dali, you have to burn Diederbrücke, you have to burn German Ritz, you have to burn everybody and reinvent yourself again from ground zero. These people that are 20 years old have to re-understand that they are so powerful, they are so strong, that just by being able to say, we want to make a world better, we want to change our world, where they can do it.
But, you know, they are tired even by our generation. You know, I have three daughters in this age, you know, about 20 years old. And so it's so heavy, you know, this weight of the European culture and all this kind of stuff around, you know. So it's, I think that's really a very important point.
Yes, they have to go away from Europe
to
redefine themselves. Europe will always be here waiting for them. But, you know, the nicest way to define the role of a mother today is that you are like a lighthouse on the cliff. And your daughters are like sailboats that are sailing away from home. Yeah. But they have to know where home is. So if something goes wrong, they can always get back home. But they have to fly away from the nest to reshape their own personality. That is the number one decision to make. Reshape your own identity and construct your own personality from scratch.
Yeah.
Without the influence of the mother, and without the influence of the mother, and without the influence of German education, and without the influence of European education. Go as far as possible to see from a different perspective what are all the weak points that we have back in Europe to come back and change everything for good.
It's
too late for us. We're too old for young people.
Explain this or to give this what I have understood. I try to understand to this younger generation. I think that's really the point, because of course we are. I'm not sure whether it's really too late. Like I think you can. You can make kind of tabula rasa in every period of your life. I think so. Mm. It's possible if you really, we are tired, of course. You know,
that's the problem.
But we could, if we really would like to do, I think we could. But what about a kind of exposition like in this house? We are meeting here in Bucerius Kunstforum. It's a fantastic exposition, kind people around and so. But, you know, to make a link between what we have been speaking about now, just at this moment, and the exposition.
Yes, I think that this exhibition today is quite interesting because it's a very, very small retrospective that really gathers amazing masterpieces by my grandfather that come from America, from France, from Spain, worldwide, you name it. And having this very, very good choice of works here define Miro very well. And how this exhibition is defining Miro? Well, it's defining Miro in a way that shows you that you have to understand how revolutionary was that artist.
The revolutionaries.
Yes, they are.
Barricade.
Yes, absolutely. The dog is coming up, man.
May I take a picture from you?
Yeah, of course.
Okay,
of course.
So you talk and...
Yes,
don't
course,
look
yes.
at the camera, I'll do it.
Of course, of course.
Notice it.
So when you are just going through this exhibition, you will see how many, many paintings are, from the very beginning, you see an artist that is struggling against all the establishments, and he's trying to go beyond those academical positionings. And at the same time, you can see how he's going over and over through this Dadaism, Surrealism, and then he's able to find himself in a very strong position. And little by little, he really settles down in a very conflictive moment when the Spanish Civil War happens.
Yeah.
And then the Second World War happens again, and then he moves back to Spain to recover from that terrible moment of our history. And little by little, what happens is that he's blossoming, he's blooming, his symbols, his iconography, his paintings are getting more and more meaningful, more and more color, more and more expressive power. And little by little, you see how he is coming to a very strong maturity until 1974. In 1974, his paintings are being sold for millions, and that's something that he cannot stand. Then he sets them on fire. He burns his canvases. And at the same time, he makes the Miro Foundation in Barcelona, the Miro Foundation in Mallorca, and he's giving so many works to these foundations and to the Pompidou and different museums worldwide, because he has understood that democracy is back in Spain, and he really believes in the United States of Europe. He really believes that the union of the Europeans will avoid more wars between neighbors. And that was his belief. That was his goal in life, to be a citizen of the United States of Europe.
Okay. So it's a kind of example, lesson of this evolution.
Absolutely.
I've been talking about, you know, for younger people even to see this kind of radical way of living and creating.
Absolutely. You have to think that when one young person, 20 years old person, will come to see Miro, this person has to change his perspective in his world or in her world. When you see Miro today at the Bucerius Kunstforum, you have to understand that generosity, creativity, and fearful devotion to your own convictions is the only way to succeed.
Yeah.
And that also the worst way to commit suicide is by repeating yourself over and over again. When you repeat yourself all the time, you will be mediocre.
Yeah, and that's imitating even, you know.
Absolutely. So that's something that cannot be done nowhere in the world. You cannot repeat yourself over and over again, no matter if you're a doctor, a lawyer, a physician, or a mathematician. But repetition is your worst enemy. And Nero was 90 years old when he passed away in Mallorca in 1983. But throughout his 90 years, he never repeated himself. He was going through ceramics, tapestries, paintings, drawings, sculptures, illustrated books, but he was always changing his methodology. He was always changing his mechanics. He was always talking to the artisans, to the craftsmanship, to see what new techniques they have invented that he can reuse and reinterpret for their own means, you know.
Yeah.
That's what really matters to him.
Last question, maybe?
No,
we have one hour.
Yeah, so. But they will come, I hope so. Because I would like to ask you for some symbols, you know, in the work of Miro, because you have been saying that, of course, it's a very deep a kind of having recreated his painting language. It's like a new kind of language he has created between, you know, letters even and symbols and so. But you can find a lot of symbols like the star. You have a star there. I like it. It's, I don't know where it's coming from. For example, it's very, very simple symbol, the star or the bird or the women. So perhaps you can show us one or two or three of his paintings and
yes.
Speak about the symbolic and how you understand it.
Yes. Symbolic is everything for Miro. Symbolic is the key to understand Miro. Symbolic is the best way to understand his creativity, because all about Miro is about his symbols.
Yeah.
And how can we understand Miro? Through reading in his painting poems. For example, this one is called Une étoile caresse le sein d'une négresse, which means that one star is caressing the breast of a naked black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a painted poem.
Yeah.
So, first of all the background is black. Second of all, the poem is written on the canvas on white.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have different symbols that have lots of sexual meaning and sexual drives.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you have the ladder of escape that is showing you the way to reach a new dimension of sexuality, of erotism, and of libido.
Mm-hmm.
How can you get one stern snube caressing the breast of a black woman through your imagination and through melting all your sexual drive, your sexual energy, through your subconsciousness,
mm-hmm.
and being strongly convinced enough to do this painting in which you mixed poetry, sensual devotion, sexual erotism, sexual mechanics, and also oil on canvas.
Yeah.
Libido was one of the most powerful engines for the surrealists. Libido was also a limestone for Sigmund Freud. Libido was extremely meaningful for my grandfather as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in this painting, you can understand how he was able to put together all these elements at once.
Okay. So I have a question.
Yes.
One, quite my, I have a lot of favorite.
Yes. One.
So even this long, you know.
Scroll.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we can speak about friendship because that's I don't know where I can find it. Just one moment. That it's in the big, yeah, it's this one.
Oh my God.
You like it.
I love
you
it.
Like everything. Oh. It's my favorite. I don't know why, but because it's speaking to me very deeply.
That's
now.
Really strong. This is really strong. This painting is very strong because it talks about dreams. Mm-hmm. This painting talks about automatism. And in 1919, there was a very important book called Magnetic Fields that was published by Philippe Soupeau and André Breton, mm-hmm. right after the end of Dadaism and before the beginning of Surrealism. And it was about automatism. Automatism is the way to escape through reason. Reason is your enemy. The process of thinking an action before committing the action is your enemy. You have to be able to just let yourself go. And that's where drugs come into play. Many people used absentia, like Picasso, or mescaline, like André Masson, or when you talk about, for example, one of the major writers of the Beat Generation, Aldous Huxley, that wrote The Doors of Perception. He was on cocaine, heroin, crack, and LSD all day long. And thus he was able to somehow let himself free from reason and get to a superior and more mystical state of your mind. So Miro, without using any drugs, just by listening to music and reading poetry, he was able to access a superior level of our subconsciousness and being able to portray the color of your dreams. Have you ever painted a dream? No way. So Miro did paint a dream in the 20s. And in this painting in the 70s, he was again painting dreams.
Okay. So fantastic one. And perhaps the last one, it's the kind of self-portrait, I think. Perhaps you know where I can find it. Because I would like to ask you a little bit your impression. I don't think up to which age you have known him. You have been 15.
15,
so
yes.
You remember him quite well, I think.
Of course.
No, where I find it, I don't know it. So well.
Yes, 1937.
Yeah.
No,
so
this one. Yes. It's a long story, but I will try to make it short.
Okay, thank you.
This painting is from 1961, I think, right? 1960. This painting is from 1960. But in 1937, my grandfather made a very good drawing of himself on pencil. And then, in 1960, he worked on a copy of that drawing from 1960. So he wanted to somehow destroy his creativity from the 30s and make it much more gestural, much more aggressive, and much more colorful, bringing this amazing hypnotic and like drug addict gaze of a man that has red eyes, round black circles, a very strong head, and a very strong body. So this is like the alter ego killing the ego. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
It's subconsciousness confronted to consciousness. It's mirror against mirror.
Yeah.
You have two mirrors in the same painting. The one you see and the one that you don't see. You have here two states of your mind. Consciousness and subconsciousness. So Miro wanted to paint consciousness and subconsciousness at the same time.
Okay.
You see? The painting on the back is Miro, in a very academical pencil drawing, and the mirror on the foreground is the alter ego, is the subconsciousness being captured and being retained and being put on the canvas.
If you are looking, you know, on all the paintings in this exposition, you are surprised if you have just in your head, you know, the Miro you can find everywhere. It's like kind and nice, and you know, it's ornamental. You can put it on your wall, you know. So and you discover, of course, I knew it, but you discover it's from new here, that it's sometimes it's really so strong that it's quite difficult to, you know, to live it. How it's possible that the image of Miró, he's really well known as a painter, is restricted to this nice ornamental part. It's a little bit like Matisse.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that basically this is the market. The market chooses the most economical and most acceptable paintings. Mm-hmm. But Miró was at the same time a very revolutionary, pessimistic and angry man. Mm-hmm. And all the frustration, all that angst, angriness and all that frustration was also coming through the brush. So you can see mm-hmm. the final painting that we have in the show, the huge painting.
Yeah.
He made that in 1973 at the age of 80 with a big broom that he was putting in with black paint, and he was really killing his own creativity mm-hmm. through this explosion of black.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on in 1973? Picasso passed away, his best friend Joan Prats passed away, there were terrible moments of political tension in Spain because Franco was dying but wasn't dead yet. In 1975 he was going to open his new foundation in Barcelona. In 1974 he was going to have the big major retrospective at the Grand Palais in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to be subversive and he wanted to be young again. He wanted to be able to prove to the world that although you have Andy Warhol with pop movement, Liechtenstein, Rauschenberg, when you have Clifford Steele, when you have Keith Haring, and you have all the abstract expressionists, you have also Chillida and Tapies in Spain, and you have Art Brut in Paris with Dubuffet and Jean Fautrier.
Mm-hmm.
So Miró said, okay, I'm 80, but I am not dead yet. And I'm going to prove to the world that I'm alive through destruction,
uh-huh.
through destroying myself, through distracting my paintings, and throwing to everybody that I'm still able to make a statement to see how you will understand who I am. Because you tried to kill me as an old surrealist that was dead before Second World War. But now, in 1975, I'm still alive and I'm doing very good things yet.
Yeah. You can remember him as a kind of angry man?
Yes,
as a little boy, yeah?
Yes, because he was extremely silent and quiet sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was with him at home. It was Sunday afternoon. It was around 5 or 6 afternoon. And I walked into the dining room and he was sitting on his armchair making sketches, and he didn't see me. So I was spying on him.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see that he was working and working and working and working and working on different sketches on paper with the pencils.
Mm-hmm.
But I could hear that for the pressure that he was putting mm-hmm. on the paper, he was breaking the pencil. The pencils were breaking because of the anger.
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying, my goodness, what is going on with this old man? The old man was very angry, you know. There was something going on that was making him very, very angry. So that
mm-hmm.
frustration and that violence was really strong in his spirit. And he was able to let that anger out
mm-hmm.
through his passion in painting.
Yeah. But not in his life.
No.
In his life,
never screaming, never hitting, never breaking a plate, never breaking a glass. The most peaceful, charming man you can ever imagine.
Okay, it's incredible. And then, and that's perhaps the last important thing for us, he have had a lot of friends. It's not even, not only the books he has been creating with, you know, poets and with colleagues and so, but it's in the last part here. But it seems to me that the friendship has been playing a big part in his life. Is it true?
Yes, he was always very devoted friend of his friends. He was very close friends to all his poet friends, painters, and sculptors and writers, and he was always in touch with them. And every single time that a poet came to him saying, "Joan, let's make a book together," he would say, "Yes, let's make a book together." And that's why you have this beautiful Adonit, yeah, the book that he made with Jacques Prévert, mm-hmm, yeah, and also Par le Seul with Tristan Tzara. You can see how amazing achievements he made throughout his lifetime. And these books, for me, are masterpieces.
Yeah, mm-hmm,
masterpieces. You know, really, really, really strong masterpieces.
So I think that friendship, real friendship, you know, is perhaps an important part in the revolution we have been speaking about.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think so.
Absolutely.
It's very
absolutely
strong thing. Yeah.
A strong thing. He always trusted his friends. He always spoke with his friends. He always wrote letters to his friends. He always wanted to see his friends, to talk about art, music, poetry, and politics, and socials, and economics. He was always very keen of his friends. So he was able to build a very strong connection with his friends. Doesn't matter if they were from Germany, from France, from Italy, from Czechoslovakia, or from Spain. That was beyond borders and beyond nationalisms. You know, it was about real friendship.
Yeah, and real last question, because I have a lot of, you know, things going on in my head. In his family, you know, because of course you are his you are always his grandson. The connection in the family has been the same thing, like with his friends, friendly and yeah. What did he learn to you personally, not just through his paintings?
Yes, well, my grandfather was a good teacher, a teacher that taught me one thing, that patience is the mother of all sciences. Don't run, walk. Don't fly, glide. Don't dive, swim. Just be able to accept that the world was not created in one day. Don't pull an apple too early from the apple tree because it may be too acid and sour. Let the apple get red and then you will enjoy it. Everything needs time. Go step by step. Like Picasso told him when my grandfather went to see him in Paris in 1920, he said, "Hola, Pablo, soy Joan, ¿cómo estás?" "Muy bien. What do you want to do, Joan?" "I want to be a painter here in Paris." "What should I do?" "Very simple. Get on the line. And when the time comes, jump into the bus."
It's nice.
Okay. That's a nice way to put it.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Yeah, thank you. Cheers with the coffee.
Cheers, cheers.